Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Good day, and welcome to another edition of the OIES podcast series. My name is James Henderson, and I'm the director of the gas program here at the Institute. And with me today, I have Alex Barnes, a visiting research fellow, who's here to discuss his recent paper entitled "Can the Current EU Regulatory Framework Deliver Decarbonisation of Gas?" Alex, welcome to the podcast for the first time, and thanks for joining us to discuss your excellent paper.
Great. Thanks a lot, James. It's good to be here.
Good. Well, nice to have you. And, you know, a complex topic to start with. So what I'd like to do, first of all, if we can, is to provide some basic context. Why don't we start by you telling us in simple terms what the goals and structure of the current regulation of the gas markets in Europe are?
Okay. Well, it's principally about two things. One is competition and the other is security of supply. So the competition, and this is the essence of the third gas directive and the related regulations, is all about enabling producers and suppliers of gas to compete so that customers get the best value for money, creating a competitive market. And in order to do that, there's quite a lot of complex regulation surrounding what's known as third-party access, regulated third-party access to the pipeline networks. This means that everybody can access the pipeline networks on a level playing field, that producers or suppliers can get them to different customers. Nobody has an unfair advantage to prevent a competing producer or a competing supplier from supplying gas to a customer. The second thing is the security of supply, and that's been more recent. And this is basically about ensuring that because Europe is import dependent, there's enough infrastructure in place to enable gas to go from where it is imported into Europe to where it is needed. So there are regulations requiring that there is sufficient cross-border infrastructure within the EU, that this is able to flow gas in both directions, and that member states have the ability to cope with the interruption to their biggest single source of supply.
So I guess we've had these two kind of pillars, if you like, and now a third one has come to the fore, namely decarbonisation. Can you tell us a little bit about what the EU goals are there?
Sure. Well, the EU for a number of years now has had the ambition of reducing greenhouse gas emissions significantly. But what has changed within the last year or so is that now it's going for climate neutrality by 2050. And this is quite a significant step. And just to put that in context, if you think in the last 30 odd years, the EU has reduced its emissions by about a quarter. In the next 30 years, it wants to eliminate them completely. Now, there are already targets in place for what to do for 2030 in terms of energy efficiency, reduction of emissions, etc., targets for how much renewables should be part of the energy mix. But there isn't anything so far in place to get us to 2050. The EU has done work on scenarios. So the Clean Planet for All analysis of a couple of years ago included a variety of scenarios as to how you could get to reducing climate change, reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But only two of their scenarios got you to climate neutrality. And they also included things that would be quite different from where we are today. So significant lifestyle changes, carbon capture and storage, or a lot of new nuclear. So there are a lot of things to put in place in order to meet those targets.
So, I mean, from what I gather from your paper, I mean, what you're suggesting in the paper is that, you know, to meet these very, very aggressive targets, you do need a change in the regulatory practices. So what are we seeing so far? What are the current plans? Are we seeing a complete change being proposed or a subtle shift?
Well, I think it's going to need to be a complete change, but the thinking at the moment is still kind of evolving. So you've had a number of papers and suggestions put out by various people, including the Commission, including ACER, the European regulator, etc. But I think people are still sort of kind of groping towards what the framework should look like. But I think we need to understand that, as we said just now, this is a complete step change. So whereas liberalization and the third gas directive was all about creating competition in an existing and mature industry, one that already supplied about a quarter of European primary energy supply, and that's much higher in some of the countries. Here you're talking about something where you're going to have to completely change that, because you're not going to be able to use natural gas in the way that you do at the moment. So to put it in context, if you use natural gas to heat your home at the moment, you're going to have to either electrify, which means using something like an air source heat pump, but that in turn requires you to completely change your energy system within your house because you can't use the same radiators. Or if your industry, you're going to have to use, or heating your home as well, you could use a different energy carrier like hydrogen, which gives no emissions when it is burnt. But of course, there isn't a hydrogen supply at the moment. And so you not only have to create the supply and enable that supply to get to customers, but in order to get it to customers, hydrogen has different properties compared to natural gas. So you can't simply just switch over from one to the other. So it's much more like when the European gas industry was being created in the first place. You're kind of starting from scratch in some sense, because you have to build up these new supply chains.
And you're starting from scratch across the whole value chain as well. I mean, we're not just talking about customers having to adapt to a new source of energy. We're talking about upstream suppliers and midstream transporters, as well as the distribution companies.
Absolutely. And I think this is something that is missing from the thought in terms of the regulation, because the regulation changed some of the relationships between people within those supplier chains and value chains for the natural gas, but it didn't fundamentally change the natural gas value chain itself. It was the same fuel being used by the same people, produced in the same way, transported in the same way, physically. Whereas here you've got that classic chicken and egg situation. If you're a potential user of hydrogen, for example, you don't know who's going to be able to supply you and at what cost. If you're a potential producer of hydrogen, you don't know how much demand there is going to be, which makes it rather difficult to invest. And then the other big difference is, of course, that whereas natural gas had an inherent economic value, it could compete with existing fuels. In fact, its original pricing was specifically designed to compete with oil or coal. With hydrogen, it costs more than current fossil fuels, and it still costs more even with current carbon prices. So you have that economic complication as well. So just cutting and pasting the existing framework won't really kind of work.
So, I mean, that's the crux, essentially, of your argument in the piece, isn't it? I mean, you're basically arguing that the current framework of regulation can't deliver the decarbonisation of gas. You talk about some of the ways that kind of ideas are being thrown around. You mentioned something called a regulatory sandbox, which I want to dig into a bit more. It sounds like policymakers understand there needs to be some shifts, but perhaps they haven't got the kind of full measure of the change that's required in the regulatory system yet.
Yes, that's right. I think, and the reason I say this is because I get a lot of, or I see a lot of comments saying that we need a regulated framework and we need regulated third-party access. But it's important to remember that regulated third-party access was brought in to address a specific market failure, namely natural monopolies of pipeline networks, because that prevented competition between producers and suppliers of gas. You don't have that at the moment because you don't have any competition in the hydrogen market. It doesn't exist yet. And interestingly, in the directive as well, it specifically allows for exemptions for emergent markets or in places where you need to invest, where it's too risky to invest under the current regulatory regime. I think the other thing which is really not appreciated at all is just the time it took to liberalize. I mean, the first gas directive was way back in 1998. And indeed, the impetus for liberalizing markets goes back to 92 and the original creation of the single market in Europe. And yet here we are, and we're only just finishing off the process. So that's 25 years. We don't have 25 years to sort it out this time round, because we're meant to be climate neutral by 2050. So I think those are some of the key sort of issues that people need to think about a bit harder. Really think about, what are you trying to achieve, and does it need regulation? You know, what market failures are you addressing? And the market failures for decarbonization are not the same as for liberalization.
And can you just, I'm just coming back to this regulatory sandbox. I mean, can you just talk, the uneducated listener through what that concept? I mean, this is where you test out various forms of regulation to see what works in a specific situation.
Yes, it's a bit unclear, to be honest. It's appeared in a couple of reports, and I have to say it's one of my least favorite phrases, because of regulatory sandbox. It's a nice soundbite, but it's not very helpful. Essentially, what it means is, as you say, that you can try out different approaches in different places. And I think, notwithstanding my dislike of the term, I think actually it's an extremely useful concept. And this is encouraging because, as I mentioned, you don't have a homogeneous industry, a pan-European industry that you're trying to regulate. You have something that you're building from scratch. So being able to try out different approaches is extremely helpful. The other aspect to bear in mind is that different countries have different reliance on gas, different forms of gas networks, etc. And so having a top-down, one-size-fits-all approach, when you don't have a pan-European industry, is perhaps, you know, not the best way to start. Whereas this more bottom-up approach, and recognizing that you're trying to get things going because of the time limits upon you, is actually, I think, really helpful.
Absolutely. And I think the other key point you've made already is that we don't actually have that much time. And so what do you think are the key parameters that we need to see put in place relatively rapidly, even if they're not direct regulation, to allow the gas industry to start to adapt to these decarbonisation goals?
Okay. The first thing is the economic case or the financial support. And there are a number of means that you can address this. You know, it could be that carbon prices go up, it could be subsidies, or it could be obligations that say by a certain date, you know, natural gas networks will not be able to operate in the same way. But you have to somehow create the framework to you know, fill in that missing money gap, as it were. Because this is going to cost. It's going to cost in terms of, because the cost of converting to hydrogen, whether it be from electricity or from natural gas, is obviously higher than current natural gas prices and the conversion of the networks. I think the other thing is that this sort of links back with the regulatory sandbox and the differences in terms of regulatory approach. Don't over-regulate. So, for example, if you've got a group of large industrial users, i.e. steel companies or chemical companies, and they enter into some form of agreement with potential hydrogen producers and they create their own little network, don't feel that you have to regulate it and copy the third-party access regime that we have now, because they're already taking on quite a lot of risk in terms of, you know, starting something new. And you don't want to limit that. That's not saying that if in, say, 30, 40 years' time, we have a big hydrogen market in the way that we have a big natural gas market, that you can't do things differently then. But there's a difference between what you do at the start for an emergent market or a developing market and what you do for a mature one. I think the other thing that would be really important is, don't pick winners. And the reason I say this is because it's very easy to say, well, obviously green hydrogen, that's hydrogen from electricity, so long as it's renewable electricity, has lower emissions than when you create blue hydrogen from either pyrolysis or methane reforming of natural gas. But it's not as simple as that, because there's the issue of how quickly you can roll out these different technologies. And we're at such an early stage, if you had a crystal ball and could predict it, then, you know, you wouldn't need to do scenarios. Scenarios aren't forecasts. They're simply trying to put a gauge as to what types of things might be possible.
A good time to put in a little plug for our colleague Ralph Dickel's paper on blue hydrogen as a catalyst for green hydrogen in the German energy economy, perhaps.
Absolutely, and I think blue hydrogen definitely has a role to play. The problem that you face is because some people are saying that it's not a good idea. Why would anybody invest in it if, for example, the Commission in its assumptions on one of its papers says there's no need for it beyond 2030? Well, why would you invest in it then? Because you don't have much time to recover the cost of your investment. But then if that means that we miss our decarbonisation targets, we're all worse off.
Indeed. And I think I just want to bring you back to that economic argument and the point about financial support. I guess it raises the issue of whether there's really a level playing field for gas. I mean, renewables, wind and solar particularly, clearly received a lot of support in terms of subsidy and feed-in tariffs or whatever. Is there a sense that gas, decarbonized gas, is going to get the same support, or are we really talking an unlevel playing field at the moment?
I think we're talking about an unlevel playing field at the moment in two ways. Firstly, there's the issue of the kind of support that you mentioned, and there's kind of this almost blanket assumption in some quarters that, well, natural gas, you're part of history now because you will have to disappear. Now, from the point of view of we have to get rid of emissions, I understand that, but it's not particularly helpful because it doesn't explain to all those consumers who use natural gas, well, what are you going to use instead? And whilst renewables are going to play a much bigger role in our economy than they do today, and rightly so, they cannot solve everything. So you can't electrify all energy demand that currently is provided for gas. So, for example, industrial processes need high temperature heat. You cannot provide that directly with electricity. We mentioned about converting homes. When you convert homes, lots of them won't be able to be insulated enough because they're so old to be able to use heat pumps. So you have real issues there. I think the other reason why the playing field isn't level is what I would regard as almost this competition between energy networks or energy carriers. So on the one hand, the electricity regulation doesn't need to really change. It has a similar approach to gas in terms of you have regulated networks, regulated third-party networks. But because you're replacing fossil fuel generation with renewables, you're not really changing all the rest of the dynamics. You know, it's still the same electricity wires. It's still the same way electricity is still being used the same way in homes, etc. So you already have a model that works. The more people use electricity, the more electricity is generated, and the more stuff that needs to be generated, the more renewables you have. With gas, because of this new value chain that we mentioned earlier, you don't have that. You have to completely change the way that it's structured and developed and create a new industry. So there's not a level playing field there in terms of enabling people to sort of invest in decarbonisation.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because a number of studies have shown that full electrification of the energy system is more expensive than a mixture of electrification and continuing some role for the gas system.
Absolutely, and I think this is where potentially, if you don't create the right regulatory framework, you can miss out on that benefit, because there's this issue, as I mentioned earlier. You know, how do you encourage production of hydrogen? Because you have to coordinate along the chain. You have to build up the chain in step, as it were, so that you have production and transportation and demand all coming on stream in a reasonably coordinated way. So to give you one example, if you were to convert a transmission network to hydrogen, everything downstream of that, every distribution network, every town, every factory, every chemical plant who might use natural gas would have to get used to hydrogen as well. But they can't. They have different constraints as to how much they can do that. You know, some processes are very sensitive to the amount of hydrogen in a natural gas stream if you're blending it, or they can't use pure hydrogen because they use natural gas as a feedstock in itself. So you have to coordinate that, and that makes it a lot more difficult than simply saying, "Well, I'm going to replace a coal-fired power station with a wind farm.
And so it raises the question, sorry to interrupt, I mean, it raises the question as to whether the industry itself across the entire value chain is presenting a coordinated response. I mean, are they telling the policymakers and the regulators the type of regulation they would like to see?
They are, and depending on which bit of the industry you talk to, you will get slightly different answers. And the reason for that is when the gas industry developed in the 60s and 70s and 80s, it was very much sort of a close-knit group, as it were, and that's partly what enabled it to develop so successfully. Now, because of liberalization, you have diverse interests. So to give you an idea of what this means is, networks, TSOs, they don't mind what sort of gas they carry, so long as they're carrying gas. Now, obviously, it's more complicated for them to go to hydrogen than to keep using natural gas, but they don't mind if that hydrogen is from green hydrogen or blue hydrogen. I mean, I'm simplifying slightly, but just to illustrate the point. Utilities are becoming increasingly energy suppliers. So, of course, they don't mind whether they're supplying electricity or natural gas or hydrogen. They're more interested in supplying energy. So their views are different. And then you have the producers of natural gas whose views might be slightly different again, because, of course, they actually do have an interest in supplying natural gas as a feedstock for hydrogen. Now, I think from a policy point of view, what you need to do is make sure that all these different interests are balanced out so that you end up getting competition between different sources of energy for the consumer. So not just favoring electrification or green hydrogen, but the key metric should essentially be the carbon footprint of the energy source that is heating your home or supplying energy to your factory.
And so essentially, we're talking about, you know, coming back to that question of competition again, the regulator has to balance an element of not picking winners with also trying to incentivize new and more expensive forms of energy supply. That's quite a difficult balance to achieve.
Yes, it is. And I think this is where, as I say, although you need regulatory clarity. So, for example, if you're going to invest in something new, it would be great to know that the goalposts aren't going to change halfway through your kind of lifetime or investment. That's the whole thinking under the underlying exemptions. So you need that kind of clarity. But what you don't need is, say, a lot of extra regulation saying you have to provide, you know, future third-party access to other potential suppliers or users, if that means that you have to create extra capacity or something which you can't pay for. And it's very different, say, the role of networks. I think, you know, one shouldn't allow TSOs as they currently exist to somehow get an unfair advantage by being involved in production of hydrogen. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that you have to burden gas producers or suppliers of hydrogen or other energy to users with the same kind of framework that you have now, because, as I say, it was designed for a mature, homogenous, pan-European market, and decarbonisation is going to be different. I think it's a question of prioritising, you know, decarbonisation first because of the time, and then once a market is established, then you can start looking more at competition.
Okay, interesting. You get into time there. As we come towards the end of our time, I want to ask you about key milestones. I mean, what do you think needs to happen in what order and, you know, by what time to allow the decarbonisation objectives to be achieved?
I think that the first key milestone is enabling that sort of support for low carbon gas technology, and this is, you know, whether it be green hydrogen or blue hydrogen, also CCS, carbon capture and storage, which can be either used to support production of blue hydrogen or for natural gas being used in existing plants, etc., because there isn't the economic case for it. I think the second key milestone is to enable projects which have got the potential to start demonstrating what can be done at a reasonable scale to go ahead. Because at the moment, I think there's a risk that if they wait for a clear regulatory framework, they might have a long wait. And at the same time, actually, we need to see how these things can work in practice, because otherwise we're just going to be sort of saying, well, will it work? Won't it? I don't know until we've seen it working in practice. And I think the other thing is much more research into what I would call the technical issues and looking at it a more bottom-up approach. So what is required in different countries? Because some countries have greater reliance on natural gas than others. And therefore, you can't just sort of do it from a top-down basis. And these are issues like conversion of networks, you know, within a country, which industries or which consumers can start using other gases other than natural gas, start using hydrogen. And this is the gas quality issue that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah. I mean, and just a final point then, you know, how serious do you think and how realistic are the EU about including decarbonized gas, I mean, in their future energy plans? And I guess I don't expect a full answer to this because it's an almost impossible question, but do you think COVID-19 and the economic crisis has provided a boost to kind of investment in decarbonization as we try and get out of this economic crisis? Or do you think, if anything, it's going to cause things to be delayed? What's your feeling around the kind of EU policy and regulation sort of catalysts?
Okay. I think the encouraging thing is that the EU has recognized that you can't just electrify. And so it is recognizing the importance of gaseous carriers like hydrogen. I think the difficulty is that they still seem to be betting all on green hydrogen. There's nothing wrong with green hydrogen in itself. I just think putting all your eggs in one basket when there are so many uncertainties, and I would use the example of nuclear here. 15 years ago, we all thought nuclear was going to be a big way forward, but we've seen what's happened with delays and cost overruns with new reactors in Europe. So I think putting all your eggs in one basket is not the best approach from a policy point of view. I think with regards to COVID-19, it is actually a great opportunity to start thinking how you can re-engineer the economy. But I think the real problem is going to be the amount of money. And this is, again, why going for options which could be more cost effective. So, for example, you know, hydrogen from natural gas would be a sensible way of reducing the burden of decarbonization, because it's going to be costly whatever we do. And because of COVID-19, everybody's got a lot tighter budgets than they did before it.
Okay, Alex, thanks. Well, that's great. And I think we're pretty much bang on time. So what I'll do is just wrap up by saying thanks very much to you for what's been a fascinating discussion. I hope that all our listeners have found it as interesting as I have. I'd certainly encourage everyone to download your excellent paper, which has, I think, just been published on our website within the last week. So with that, it just remains for me to thank you all for listening and to say
thank
goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.